Have you ever found yourself just watching a hockey game and for the life of you just can't figure out why the pace feels so like dramatically different from the game you watched the night before?
It's a completely different sport half the time.
Right. Like one night it is this breathtaking end-to-end track meet, odd man rushes, highlight reel passes, just high-flying action. And then the very next night, you're watching two entirely different teams, and the game is just a miserable, grinding slog.
It really is.
It feels like 60 minutes of guys just intentionally throwing the puck into the corner and, I don't know, wrestling for it. The ice feels small, the game feels suffocated.
Absolutely.
And if you've ever played or coached or, just obsessively watched the sport, you know that the answer to why that happens, it actually doesn't lie in the offensive zone. The entire identity of a hockey game is dictated by just 50 feet of ice, the middle third, the neutral zone.
It is the it's the architectural foundation of the sport, and honestly, it's the most crucial battleground on the rink. But people naturally gravitate toward the highlight packages, right? The spectacular saves, the top shelf snipes. We spend our whole lives watching what happens directly in front of the two nets.
Because that's where the goals happen.
Exactly. And because of that, it is just incredibly easy to completely miss the complex high-speed chess match that dictated how the puck even arrived in that dangerous area to begin with.
Right.
The neutral zone is where the actual game is won or lost.
Which is exactly the mission of our deep dive today. So, for you listening, we aren't here to just give you a glossary of hockey terms. We are going to build a comprehensive, high-level mental model of how to actually control the middle of the ice.
Yeah, a real masterclass.
Because the reality is, if your team can master this 50-foot space, you dictate the terms of engagement. You force the opponent to play your style. You decide if tonight is going to be a track meet or a slog.
And the terrifying part of that reality is the sheer lack of time you have to impose your will.
Let's put a stopwatch on this environment for a second.
Right.
A strong skater at the professional level, or even high amateur level, crosses the 50 feet of the neutral zone in roughly 3 seconds.
Wow.
3 seconds.
3 seconds. That is the entire window a puck carrier has to scan the ice, read the opponent's defensive posture, calculate the velocities of nine other players, choose a tactical response, and execute a physical skill.
3 seconds to process all of that. I mean, think about that time frame. If you compare the neutral zone to, say, the midfield in soccer or the line of scrimmage in football, it shares that identity of being the transition engine of the sport.
Sure.
But in football, a quarterback has pre-snap reads, right? They have a huddle. They have time to survey a static
Yeah, the
defense.
defense is just standing there.
And in soccer, a center midfielder can put their foot on the ball, hold possession, and just let the play develop over 10 or 15 seconds.
Exactly. But because of the sheer velocity of hockey, the neutral zone is this pressure cooker that never turns off.
Never.
And that speed, it forces players to rely on ingrained recognition rather than conscious thought. You don't have time to consciously say, well, they're in this specific formation, therefore I must do X.
Right, you'd get crushed.
You get crushed. You have to recognize the geometry instantly. So today, we are going to tear down that geometry.
Love it.
We're going to examine the rules governing the lines, explore the nuance of gap control, break down the sophisticated defensive structures designed to completely ruin your night, and finally, look at the systematic ways an offense can dismantle those structures.
So I want to give you, the listener, a focal point before we get into the heavy tactical breakdown. I want you to let this one specific question marinate in the back of your mind as we go through this.
It's a great question.
When I have the puck in the neutral zone, who is actually deciding what I do with it? Is it me or is it the opponent?
That is just a brilliant framing mechanism. Because a truly elite defensive structure isn't just about blocking your path, it is fundamental design to give you the illusion of choice.
The illusion of choice.
Exactly. It wants you to feel like you are making a read and taking the best available option, when in reality, the defense mathematically engineered the ice to force you into that exact decision 3 seconds ago.
Man, I love that idea of psychological manipulation on the ice. So let's start with the literal canvas this is painted on, the geometry and the rule book.
Let's do it.
Any knowledgeable hockey fan knows the basic functions of the blue lines and the center red line, right? We all know an offside blows the play dead. But the deeper you look at how the specific rule books handle the physics of a skater in motion, the more you realize how significantly these lines alter a player's entry mechanics.
Oh, absolutely.
So let's look at the defensive blue line first. The line the attacking team actually has to cross.
Right. The complexity here is entirely about how a player times their stride. Because for a player to be deemed offside, both of their skates have to completely cross the leading edge of the blue line before the puck crosses.
Yeah.
If you keep one skate on or behind the line, you are legally onside.
Right.
But the fascinating divergence in the rule books comes down to the airborne trailing skate.
Okay, paint a picture for us here.
So imagine an attacker striding forward. Their lead foot is deep in the offensive zone, and their trailing leg is extended behind them, just hovering in the air over the blue line while they desperately reach their stick back to accept a pass. Are they onside?
Well, under NHL rules and the international IIHF rules, yes. An airborne trail skate hovering over the vertical plane of the blue line keeps you onside. You don't need physical contact with the ice.
Right.
But this is where it gets incredibly crazy for anyone playing outside those specific leagues.
Completely. Because if you are playing under USA Hockey, specifically looking at Rule 630A, or if you are up in Canada playing under Hockey Canada's Rule 6.1, that airborne skate means absolutely nothing.
Nothing at all.
The player is offside. Both of those massive amateur rule books strictly require physical skate contact with the ice surface or the blue line itself to be considered onside.
Which fundamentally changes the biomechanics of receiving a pass on the rush.
It really does.
I mean, if I'm playing in a junior league under Hockey Canada and I'm stretching for a pass at the blue line, I have to consciously drag my back skate blade on the physical ice.
Yeah, you have to fight your own body.
Exactly. I have to alter my natural skating stride, dragging friction against the ice just to stay legal. If I make a perfectly athletic highlight reel play where my leg lifts naturally, the whistle blows.
You've hit on the exact practical implication. You literally have to know which rulebook you are playing under to know how to time and physically execute your stride at high speed.
That's crazy.
The NHL changed their rule to the vertical plane interpretation, specifically to increase offense and allow for those athletic stretching entries without blowing the whistle on technicality.
All right, they want goals.
Exactly. But the amateur books kept the physical contact rule primarily because it is significantly easier for a single referee or linesman to officiate.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, judging a hovering foot at 30 kilometers an hour is incredibly difficult. Listening for the scrape of a skate or looking for physical contact is just much more definitive.
That makes total sense from an officiating standpoint, even if it's super frustrating for the players. Now, moving 50 feet up the ice, we hit the center red line. Again, we all know the icing rule.
Right.
Shoot it from behind the red line. It crosses the far goal line untouched. Whistle blows, defensive zone face-off. But the variations here, particularly regarding the penalty kill, are just as impactful, aren't they?
They really are.
Yeah.
The standard exception everyone knows is that if your team is playing shorthanded, the icing rule is waived. You can fire it down the ice all day long to relieve pressure.
Right.
But even at the highest levels, there are highly specific carve-outs. Like if you look at NHL Rule 81.6, if a team is shorthanded because they took a major penalty, but there is nobody currently sitting on the penalty bench to serve it, which happens in very specific concurrent penalty situations, the icing exception doesn't always apply in the way you might assume.
Wow, okay.
But the most important variation is, again, in the amateur development ranks.
You're talking about the USA Hockey restriction on shorthanded icing.
Yes. Under USA Hockey Rule 6TD4B1, they completely stripped away the shorthanded icing exemption for younger age groups.
Wait, really?
Yeah. If you are playing below the youth 15 only level or girls 16U, you do not get to ice the puck in the penalty kill. If you clear it down the ice, the whistle blows and the faceoff comes right back to your defensive zone.
Which is a massive philosophical statement by USA Hockey. I mean, every traditional coaching instinct says, you know, we're down a man, get it out of danger, fire it hard off the glass.
Just survive.
Exactly. But the governing body is intentionally stepping in and saying, no, we don't care if you're under pressure. We want you to learn how to stick handle, pass, and formulate a controlled breakout even when you are outnumbered.
Yeah.
They are prioritizing the development of high-pressure puck skills over the tactical ease of just surviving a penalty kill.
It forces defensemen to actually read the neutral zone instead of just treating the red line as a trigger to slap the puck away.
Right.
And, speaking of lines acting as triggers, we really cannot discuss the geometry of the neutral zone without addressing a rule that is technically dead, yet still fundamentally shapes how the game is played today.
Ah, yes.
We need to talk about the ghost rule. The two-line pass.
The two-line pass. So historically, you could not pass the puck from your own defensive zone across your blue line and across the center red line to a teammate without it being touched by someone in between.
Right.
It was the ultimate restriction on transition speed. But as we know, the NHL killed that rule coming out of the 2004-2005 lockout.
Yeah, it's long gone.
If you look at NHL Rule 83 today, which covers offside, there is zero mention of a two-line provision. It's totally absent from the IIHF and USA Hockey books as well.
It is entirely dead in competitive hockey. But what is endlessly amusing is how it survives as a cultural fossil in the recreational world.
Oh, this is great.
If you look at this CARA-A recreational rulebook, which governs a massive portion of Canadian adult and beer leagues, Rule 73 defers explicitly abolishes the two-line pass in its text. It confirms the red line is not in play for passes.
Right.
However, they accidentally left the referee signal for the two-line pass printed in the appendix of that exact same rule book.
That is hilarious.
It still instructs referees that the signal for a red line offside pass is an arm extended at shoulder level pointing toward the center red line.
The rule book is literally haunting itself. You have adult league players screaming about a rule that their own book contradicts in the appendix.
Exactly.
But from a high-level tactical standpoint, why are we spending time on a dead rule? Like, why does the absence of the two-line pass matter to a modern team?
Because the death of that rule gave birth to the foundational concept of modern neutral zone destruction. The stretch pass. Everything we are going to discuss later regarding how to shatter a passive defensive trap relies entirely on the fact that you are legally allowed to bypass the entire neutral zone with one 70-foot pass.
Right.
When the two-line pass existed, a defense only had to defend the 50 feet in front of them. Now, a defense has to respect the threat of a player standing 80 feet away on the far blue line.
It stretches them out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It stretches the defensive structure vertically, which inherently opens up horizontal seams underneath it.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't fully internalize that the entire length of the ice is available to you, you're playing a modern game with vintage constraints.
So the death of the rule expanded the usable real estate of the rink. That brings us to the stakes of this real estate. Why is this specific 50-foot zone the place that mathematically dictates the outcome of games? Let's look at the analytics.
Let's do it. The stakes are rooted in the catastrophic nature of a mistake in this specific geography. A turnover in the neutral zone is definitively the most expensive mistake you can make in hockey.
Okay, let's break down why that is. Because a casual observer might assume turning the puck over in your own defensive corner is worse, because the opponent is instantly 10 feet from your goalie. Why is center ice more dangerous?
It comes down to momentum, direction, and structural posture. If you turn the puck over deep in your own corner, it is absolutely dangerous. However, if the puck is in your corner, all five of your players are already collapsed into the defensive zone.
Right.
They are facing the puck. They are in a defensive protective posture. The house is guarded, even if the enemy is inside the gates.
Right. Your team is already packed in.
But consider a turnover at the center red line. Your team was likely in transition. You had two, maybe three forwards accelerating up the ice, moving toward the offensive zone. When the puck turns over, those forwards are instantly caught moving the wrong way at high speed. It takes time and enormous energy to stop, turn around, and accelerate back.
Yeah, that's a tough pivot.
Meanwhile, your defensemen, who were stepping up to support the rush, are caught flat-footed in open ice. The opposing team scoops up the loose puck and immediately accelerates back towards your net.
Ouch.
This is the birthplace of the odd man rush. You are shifting from offense to defense while moving backward against attackers moving forward at top speed.
It catches your entire five-man unit in a state of structural vulnerability. The defense is exposed, the forwards are trapped behind the play, and the goalie is left out to dry.
Exactly.
So avoiding turnovers is critical, but what about the offensive side? How does the neutral zone generate actual scoring?
This is where we look at a really groundbreaking piece of hockey analytics.
Oh, the Sloan paper.
Yes. At the 2013 MIT Sloan Sports Analytics Conference, Eric Kolsky, who is now a high-level NHL executive, and his colleagues presented a paper where they hand-tracked 330 NHL games from the 2011-12 season. They were measuring how zone entries impacted shot generation.
And what was the mathematical verdict?
They proved that carrying the puck into the offensive zone with control produces roughly twice the unblocked shot attempts compared to just dumping the puck in and chasing it at five-on-five play.
Twice as many.
Twice.
So if a player has the skill to navigate the neutral zone and carry the puck over the blue line on their stick, they are literally doubling their team's offensive output for that specific sequence compared to a player who just safely chips it into the corner. That is a massive statistical advantage.
It is. But the most profound insight from that paper wasn't just the value of the carry-in. It was what they discovered about player talent over a whole season.
Okay, what was that?
They found that once a team actually establishes possession in the offensive zone, the number of shots they generate per possession fluctuates wildly. It is heavily driven by luck, bounces, and chaos.
Right.
It wasn't a reliable, repeatable indicator of a player's individual talent from game to game.
So what did separate the consistently elite players from the average ones? Where was the repeatable skill?
The repeatable skill lived entirely in the neutral zone.
Oh, wow.
The talent component of a player's shot differential, meaning their ability to consistently ensure their team takes more shots than the opponent when they are on the ice, comes almost entirely from their ability to successfully execute controlled zone entries and, conversely, deny controlled entries to the opponent defensively.
That's huge.
Yeah. The talent isn't just the flashy moves in the offensive corner. The talent is the systematic transportation of the puck through the middle third.
Which completely redefines how we should evaluate players.
Yeah.
The guy who safely chips it deep every single time might be making the safe play, but mathematically, he is starving his team of offense.
Precisely.
If you win the neutral zone, you guarantee offensive volume. If you lose it, you are relying entirely on offensive zone luck.
Could have said it better.
Okay, let's shift into the vocabulary of the ice. Because before we can talk about how to build or destroy a trap, we need to ensure we're speaking the exact same structural language.
Very true.
When coaches draw on the whiteboard, they use designations like F1, F2, F3, D1, and D2. But there is a massive point of confusion here for people who grew up thinking purely in terms of centers, left wingers, and right wingers.
This is a vital paradigm shift for understanding modern hockey. When we discuss neutral zone systems, F1, F2, and F3 are explicitly roles, not fixed positions.
So F1 doesn't automatically mean the center.
Never assume that.
Right.
These roles are defined dynamically by the order of arrival at the puck or the physical proximity to the play in transition.
Okay, so how does that work in practice?
If a loose puck gets chipped out to the neutral zone and the right winger is the closest player who gets there first, for that specific sequence, the right winger is F1. The second forward to arrive into the structure is F2, and the highest forward is F3. You have to read the ice fluidly. If players try to rigidly stick to their printed positional names during a high-speed transition, the system collapses because they will be skating out of their way to get to a predefined spot.
It's organized chaos. You arrive first, you do the first job, you arrive second, you do the second job. What about the defensemen? Are D1 and D2 based on arrival time as well?
For defensemen, it is almost entirely based on geography. D1 is the strong side defenseman, meaning the defenseman currently occupying the side of the ice where the puck is located.
Right.
D2 is the weak side defenseman, occupying the side of the ice away from the puck. If the puck is passed across the ice, D1 and D2 instantly swap designations.
Strong side is puck side, weak side is away.
Sure.
Got it. Now let's clarify a few tactical terms. When someone talks about the wall, a fan immediately pictures the physical fiberglass board surrounding the rink. But in a tactical meeting, the wall means something entirely different, right?
Context is everything. Yes, playing a puck off the wall means using the boards, but when we talk about neutral zone systems, the wall describes a line of skaters strung horizontally across the width of the ice.
Like a literal human wall.
Exactly. If a defending team sets up three players flat across the red line, shoulder to shoulder, covering the three passing lanes, they have built a wall. It is designed to act exactly like a physical barrier to deny entry.
And when a puck carrier is trying to navigate along the actual physical boards, they have two primary options when facing pressure. A rim or a reverse. I see players at the amateur level mix the timing of these up constantly. What is the fundamental difference in purpose?
They are directional opposites, designed to solve completely different types of defensive pressure. A rim is when you send the puck hard onward around the boards, following the curve of the glass, usually past a defending player to a teammate further up the ice.
So you're pushing it forward?
Yeah. You use a rim to beat a defender who is stepping up laterally to pinch you against the boards. You're essentially bypassing them in the direction you were already traveling.
So a rim continues the forward momentum of the play. What about the reverse?
a reverse sends the puck backward against the flow of play into the empty space a forechecker has just vacated.
Right.
Imagine a forechecker coming at you down the boards with reckless speed, completely overcommitting to the hit. Instead of trying to force the puck through them, you simply bank the puck backward off the boards.
That's so clever.
Your defense partner, who should be trailing the play and reading that pressure, swoops in to pick up the reverse puck with all the time and space in the world because the forechecker took themselves completely out of the play.
A rim beats lateral pressure. A reverse punishes over-aggressive forward pressure. Excellent. Now, here is a pair of terms that I hear minor hockey coaches scream from the bench all the time, often interchangeably, which drives me crazy. Step up versus pinch.
Using them interchangeably is a massive coaching error because they describe actions in entirely different zones with entirely different risk profiles.
Okay, let's break them down.
A step up occurs in the neutral zone or right at your own defensive blue line. It describes a defender moving forward, closing the physical gap between themselves and an oncoming attacker, trying to engage or force a decision before the attacker gains the zone.
The analogy I always use for a step up is meeting a visitor at your front gate. You are walking out to greet them before they actually step foot on your lawn. You are protecting your territory by addressing the threat early. So what is a pinch?
A pinch happens at the offensive blue line, deep in the opponent's zone. It is when an attacking defenseman steps down the wall, away from the safety of the blue line, to aggressively challenge a winger in an attempt to keep a clearing attempt inside the offensive zone.
To continue the property analogy, if a step up is meeting someone at your front gate, a pinch is climbing over their back fence into their yard to steal their lawnmower. It's an aggressive offensive move into enemy territory.
That is a very aggressive analogy, but structurally accurate. And the risk profile is what separates them. If you misread a step up at your own blue line and get beaten, the attacker is instantly on a breakaway against your goaltender.
That's bad.
The penalty for failure is immediate and severe. If you miss a pinch deep in the offensive zone, you have given up an odd man breakout, yes. But the opponent still has to travel 150 feet through the neutral zone to get to your net. Your forwards have a chance to back check and recover.
So the geography dictates the risk.
All right, we have our vocabulary locked in. Let's move into the meat of the masterclass, defensive structures.
My favorite part.
This is where we learn how teams systematically build that illusion of choice we talked about earlier. We are going to move from the most conservative containment structures up to the most aggressive pressure systems. Let's start with the absolute baseline, the classic 1-2-2 containment. How is this built? 1-2-2 is the most ubiquitous neutral zone structure in hockey. First, understand the naming convention. The numbers are always read from the puck outward, meaning the first number is the layer of players closest to the opponent's net.
Okay, so starting from their end.
So 1-2-2 means you have one forward F1 pressuring high. You have a second layer of two forwards F2 and F3 spaced horizontally across the middle of the ice. And finally, you have your two defensemen, D1 and D2, holding the back layer near your own blue line.
So it's essentially a triangle of forwards up top, backed by a flat line of defensemen. What is the actual objective of that single F1 up high? Are they trying to strip the puck carrier?
Not primarily, and this is where amateur players often break the system. If F1 tries to blindly attack the puck carrier to steal it, they easily get beaten by a simple pass, and the system instantly collapses into a 5-on-4 disadvantage. F1 is a sheepdog. Their sole responsibility is to take away the middle of the ice and force the puck carrier to move toward one specific side of the boards. They skate a sweeping, curved route that intentionally blocks the passing lane behind the net or across the ice, showing the carrier only one viable path out of their zone.
So F1 is just herding them into an alleyway. Then what happens?
Once F1 successfully herds the carrier toward the strong side wall, the trap springs to the next phase. F2, who was waiting in that middle layer, reads the direction of the play and steps up to apply hard pressure on the winger who is receiving the puck on the boards.
Okay.
While F2 attacks the wall, F3 hangs slightly back in the middle lane to intercept any desperation cross-ice passes. The defensemen simply hold the blue line, ensuring nothing gets behind them.
It sounds incredibly solid. You herd them, you pressure them on the wall, you cover the middle. What is the inherent vulnerability of the 1-2-2 containment?
The vulnerability is baked into its conservative nature. It deliberately concedes the first pass. Because F1 is merely herding and not forcing an immediate error, an opponent with high hockey IQ and elite passing skills can simply wait. They can pass the puck D to D behind their own net, forcing F1 to skate back and forth, exhausting the sheepdog. A patient team doesn't have to force the puck into the F2 pressure. They could just hold possession until the defensive structure falls asleep or makes a positional mistake.
It relies on the offense getting impatient. So that is the containment version. Let's talk about the notorious variation of this alignment. The 1-2-2 trap.
Oh boy.
When hockey fans hear the trap, they instantly picture the mid-1990s New Jersey Devils ruining the entertainment value of the sport by suffocating the life out of every game.
Which is an incredibly enduring piece of hockey mythology.
Uh-huh.
The 1-2-2 trap utilizes the exact same numerical shape as the containment we just discussed. One high, two in the middle, two in the back. But the difference is entirely geographical. The entire five-man structure is retreated backward into the neutral zone.
How far back?
In the containment version, F1 is deep in the offensive zone, pushing the play. In the trap, F1 glides backward, hovering passively near the opponent's blue line.
Okay.
F2 and F3 drop all the way back to establish their lair at the center red line. And the defensemen are anchored firmly on their own defensive blue line.
You are literally giving the opponent their entire defensive zone and half of the neutral zone completely for free. Why on earth would you concede that much ice?
Because the mastermind concept of the trap is that you are not trying to stop the attack from starting. You are actively inviting the attack into a highly congested funnel.
Right.
By giving them free ice up to the red line, you tempt the puck carrier to build up speed. They skate right up to the red line, feeling confident, and suddenly they smash into F2 and F3 waiting on the walls with the defenseman perfectly layered behind them.
And the goal is to kill the play at the red line specifically. Why is a turnover at the red line more lethal than a turnover at the blue line?
Because of the relative positioning of the attacking forwards. When a team attacks a trap, their wingers are usually skating hard up the boards, anticipating a pass to gain the blue line.
Yeah.
If the defense creates a turnover at the red line, those attacking wingers have usually already skated past the puck. They are caught deep behind the play. The defending team recovers the puck at center ice and instantly transitions into a 3-on-2 or a 2-on-1 counterattack.
Oh, wow.
The trap isn't just about defense. It is an engineered machine for generating odd man counterattacks.
Okay, I have to ask about the history here. Did Jacques Lemaire and the 1995 Devils actually invent this evil genius funnel?
They absolutely did not. The history of the trap is a fascinating study in how we perceive winning. Lemaire coached that 95 Devils team, yes, but he learned the fundamental concepts of it while playing for the dynastic Montreal Canadiens in the 1970s.
Really?
Yeah. Pierre Page, a highly respected coach and GM, famously pointed out that Montreal had been trapping for 40 years, forcing teams wide, locking down the middle, creating turnovers. But because Montreal possessed generational offensive talents like Guy Lafleur and scored a mountain of goals in transition, nobody complained. It was viewed as brilliant, fluid hockey.
But when New Jersey did it with less flashy superstars, it was suddenly an abomination that was destroying the sport.
Precisely. The perception of a tactic is entirely dependent on the aesthetic of the outcome. And even in the modern NHL era, the Devils weren't the first to explicitly run it. Roger Nielsen implemented the exact same retreated 1-2-2 system with the New York Rangers during the 1992-93 season.
A Rangers team with Mark Messier, how did that go over?
Terribly. He was fired mid-season. The players, particularly Captain Mark Messier, absolutely despised playing it. It felt entirely too passive and counterintuitive to the aggressive North American mindset of the era. They didn't want to retreat and wait. They wanted to hunt.
But you rarely see a pure 60-minute 1-2-2 trap played in the NHL anymore. What killed it? Did coaches just decide it was too boring?
Coaches never abandon a tactic because it's boring. They abandon it because it stops winning. The rulebook killed the pure trap. Coming out of the 2004-2005 lockout, the NHL recognized the game was suffocating, so they made massive structural changes.
Like what?
First, they cracked down strictly on obstruction. In the 90s, the trap worked, because F2 and F3 could literally hook, hold, and physically drag down players trying to skate through the neutral zone. When holding became a strict penalty, players could simply skate through the funnel.
They also added the goalie trapezoid, right?
Yes, which prevented elite puck-handling goalies like Martin Brodeur from acting as a third defenseman. If you dumped the puck past the trap, Brodeur used to just go into the corner, retrieve it, and fire it right back up the ice. The trapezoid forced the defenseman to go back and retrieve the puck under heavy forechecking pressure.
Makes sense.
And finally, as we discussed in Module 1, they legalized the two-line pass. If a team sets up a passive 1-2-2 trap at the red line today, the puck carrier doesn't skate into it. They just fire a 70-foot stretch pass right over the trap to a forward waiting at the far blue line.
Which ruins the whole thing.
Exactly. The legal stretch pass shattered the spatial dominance of the trap. Today, it is used situationally, maybe to protect a third period lead, but it is dead as a full game identity.
RIP the trap. So if the 1-2-2 retreated trap is functionally obsolete against modern passing, what replaced it? What is the default defensive structure in high-level hockey today?
The modern standard is the 1-3-1.
1-3-1. So we have F1 up top, a line of three players across the middle of the ice, and a single solitary defenseman in the back layer.
Exactly. F1 applies mild pressure to dictate the side of the ice.
Mm.
But the core of the system is the middle layer. F2, F3, and one defenseman form a completely flat horizontal wall across the width of the ice, usually sitting just inside their own blue line or at the red line. They cover the left wall, the center lane, and the right wall. The remaining defenseman acts as the sole safety net, anchored deep in the defensive zone.
A flat three-man wall across the ice. That visually sounds impossible to pass through.
And that is its brilliant proposition. The 1-3-1 does not aggressively try to take the puck from you. It offers you possession of the puck, but dictates that you can only operate under terrible spatial terms. Because three players are fanned out horizontally, there are virtually no forward passing seams. It forces the attacking team to attempt to physically carry the puck through three perfectly spaced defenders who are waiting for you.
If it's that structurally sound, have teams ever just looked at it and refused to play along?
They have, and it resulted in one of the most bizarre spectacles in modern NHL history.
That could tell.
November 2011. The Tampa Bay Lightning, coached by Guy Boucher, were running a rigid 1-3-1. They were playing the Philadelphia Flyers, coached by Pierre Laviolette. Tampa set up their three-man wall in the neutral zone and waited. Chris Pronger, the Flyers defenseman, had the puck in his own zone. He looked up, saw the wall, and simply stopped skating. He stood perfectly still with the puck on his stick.
What did Tampa do?
Nothing. Tampa's F1 refused to forecheck because doing so would break the structure. The Flyers refused to advance into a mathematically disadvantageous trap. For extended, agonizing periods of time, all 10 skaters on the ice literally stood completely still.
That's incredible.
The referees didn't know what to do because technically no rules were being broken. Philadelphia was playing a high-stakes game of chicken. Laviolette was essentially screaming at the league, look at the system, look at what it's doing to the sport. Tampa eventually won the game 2-1, but the league debated the ethics and tactics of that single game for weeks.
I'm not attacking that wall. Well, I'm not leaving the wall. That is incredible psychological warfare. But no system is perfect. If an attacking team refuses to stand still, how do they exploit a flat three-man wall? What is the fatal flaw of the 1-3-1?
The fatal flaw is human impatience. The 1-3-1 requires absolute discipline from the three players forming the wall. They must stay strictly in their vertical lanes. If one of those three players, let's say the center, gets impatient and decides to leave their lane to chase the puck carrier laterally, a massive seam opens up instantly where that player used to be.
Oh, I see.
And because the system only employs a single defenseman in the back layer, that lone safety net physically cannot cover two passing lanes at once. The moment the wall breaks its horizontal discipline, the entire system shatters and the offense pours through.
So you bait them into moving. Okay, we've covered the containment, the retreated trap, and the 1-3-1 wall. What about the situational extremes? What does a team run when they are down a goal with 2 minutes left and need absolute chaos versus when they are up a goal and just want the clock to bleed out?
The extreme aggressive option is simply called pressure. It is essentially abandoning the neutral zone to run a 2-1-2 offensive forecheck. You commit two forwards deep into the opponent's zone to relentlessly hunt the puck.
Which means you only have three guys left to defend the entire rest of the rink.
Exactly. You have F3 acting as a lone middle layer and your two defensemen. The risk profile is astronomical. If the opposing team manages to make one single clean pass to beat your two deep forecheckers, they immediately bypass half your team.
Yeah.
Your F3 is suddenly facing a 3-on-2 or even a 3-on-1 rush, bearing down on your defenseman. It is mathematical suicide under normal conditions, which is why you only deploy it when you are trailing late in the game and are desperate to force a turnover deep in enemy territory.
High risk, high reward. And the opposite stream, the ultimate turtle shell.
That is the 1-4 retreat. You leave one forward nominally up ice, usually just waving their stick, and your other four skaters retreat all the way back to form a completely flat line standing directly on your own defensive blue line.
Four guys standing shoulder to shoulder on the blue line.
It entirely concedes the neutral zone. You are telling the opponent they can have all 50 feet of the middle ice for free. The offensive drawback is that the 1-4 generates absolutely zero counterattack capability.
Because everyone is back.
Right. If your team recovers the puck, all five of your players are already standing static in your own end. You have zero momentum and nobody up the ice to pass to. Every clearance just becomes a desperate dump out, and the opponent just picks it up and attacks you again.
So it's pure survival mode. You use it to defend a 6-on-5 when the other team pulls their goalie, or in the final 30 seconds.
Correct. And a warning to amateur coaches. If you employ the 1-4 as your default defensive system for youth players, you are committing coaching malpractice.
Oh, wow.
You might win a few low-scoring games, but your players will never learn how to transition the puck, how to read gaps, or how to counterattack. It stunts development entirely.
Okay, one final defensive structure before we summarize. I hear broadcasters mention the left-wing lock occasionally. How does that fit into this spectrum?
The left-wing lock is a fascinating hybrid system. It attempts to marry aggressive offensive forechecking with extreme defensive safety. It begins looking like a standard 2-1-2 forecheck. The center and the right winger go deep into the offensive zone to hunt the puck aggressively.
So where does the lock come in?
The moment possession is lost, or even if it looks like possession might be lost, the left winger immediately abandons the offensive zone and drops all the way back to form a flat 3-man line with the two defensemen in the neutral zone.
So it rapidly morphs from a 2-1-2 into a 2-3 defensive posture.
Yes. The tactical brilliance is that you maintain heavy pressure on the opponent's breakout with your two deep forwards, but you eliminate the risk of giving up an odd man rush because your left winger has already retreated to act as a third defenseman.
It sounds like a cheat code. You get the offense of a forecheck and the defense of a trap. Where did this come from?
The tactical lineage is European. It was developed in Czechoslovakia in the 1970s, specifically to counter the dominant, overwhelming offensive transition of the Soviet national teams. The Czechs needed a way to slow down the red machine without entirely parking the bus.
Makes sense.
Fast forward to the mid-1990s, an assistant coach named Barry Smith adapted the concepts for the narrower North American rinks and brought it to the Detroit Red Wings under the legendary Scotty Bowman. Detroit utilized it to win the President's Trophy and multiple Stanley Cups.
If it won cups, why isn't every team running it today? What is the catch?
The catch is the tremendous burden it places on your personnel. It requires your left winger to possess the defensive instincts, backward skating ability, and gap control of a professional defenseman, which is rare.
Very.
Furthermore, if your left winger happens to be your most dynamic offensive player, you are completely neutralizing them in transition. Instead of flying up the wing on a counterattack, they are stuck 100 feet back playing defense. And fundamentally, if the winger is late to read the play and fails to drop back in time, the system breaks. You end up with a broken forecheck up high and a vulnerable, standard 2-man defense in the back.
It requires perfectly versatile players to execute. Okay, we have covered an immense amount of structural theory. Let's pause and consolidate. For you listening, what should we remember here? If I'm trying to hold on to the core concepts of these structures, what is the through line?
The through line is this. Defensive structures are conscious choices, not permanent laws. You deploy them based on the score, the time remaining, and the opponent's tendencies. Remember the numbering convention. The first number is always the layer of players pressuring closest to the opponent's net. The 1-2-2 containment herds you. The 1-2-2 trap funnels you to the red line. The 1-3-1 builds a flat wall offering bad terms. And the 1-4 completely concedes the neutral zone for survival.
That perfectly sets the stage for Module 4. Gap control and blue line battles. This is where individual skills meet team concepts. Let's talk about gap control. As a fan, when I watch a defenseman getting roasted off the rush, constantly backing up, giving the attacker 10 feet of space, letting them walk right into the zone, my immediate thought is, man, that defenseman is too slow. They have terrible gap control.
And that is the single biggest misconception amateur players and fans have about defending the rush. People assume that maintaining a tight gap, which means keeping the attacker within 1 to 1.5 stick lengths, is purely a measure of the defenseman's individual backward skating ability.
If it's not just the defenseman's skating, what dictates the gap?
Gap control is a holistic 5-man outcome. It is almost entirely dictated by the forwards.
How does a forward impact a defenseman's gap?
Through back pressure. This is the golden rule of rush defense. Forwards determine the gap. Imagine an attacker flying through the neutral zone with the puck. If three defending forwards are tracking back hard skating aggressively back toward their own end, hunting the attacker from behind, the defending defenseman looking at the play knows they have help.
Right?
Therefore, the defenseman can confidently step up, stop their feet, and squeeze the puck carrier over the tight gap.
Because if the defenseman steps up, misses, and gets beaten, the attacker simply skates right into the back-checking forwards who are collapsing from behind. The puck is still recovered.
Precisely. The defenseman is insulated from catastrophic failure. Now, reverse the scenario. The attacker is flying up the ice. The defending defenseman looks up and sees their three forwards gliding lazily near the center red line, completely out of the play. In that scenario, the defenseman must back off and concede a loose gap. They have no choice.
Because if they step up with no back pressure and get beat, it is a clean, uncontested breakaway for the opponent.
Exactly. So the next time you're watching a game and a team's defense looks porous, constantly backing in and allowing easy zone entries, do not immediately blame the defenseman. Watch the forwards. I guarantee you will see a lack of back pressure. The exact same defenseman will look elite on a Tuesday and hopeless on a Thursday, depending entirely on the work ethic of their forwards tracking back through the neutral zone.
That is a total paradigm shift for watching the game. The defense's bravery is entirely reliant on the forwards' work ethic. Now, let's look at it from the offensive side of the rush. When a team is attacking with speed, who is actually the most dangerous player on the ice?
Counterintuitively, it is rarely the player carrying the puck.
Yeah.
The most dangerous player on a rush is the late man, also known as the trailer.
The guy arriving last. Why is the trailing player more dangerous than the guy driving to the net?
It exploits human neurology and visual tracking. When a two-man rush enters the zone, the defending defensemen naturally fixate their vision and momentum on the immediate threats. The puck carrier and the forward driving hard to the far post. Their brains are calculating the immediate geometry of those two players. A highly intelligent forward will intentionally delay their route. They will glide, staying 10 to 15 feet behind the primary rush.
So they let the play pull the defense deep.
Exactly. As the primary rush drives deep, the defensemen and the back-checking forwards collapse low toward the net to defend it. As they collapse, the high slot, the most dangerous shooting area on the ice, completely opens up.
Wow.
The late man arrives into that empty space right as the first wave vacates it. Because human nature compels defenders to watch the puck deep in the corner, that second wave trailer is practically invisible. A simple drop pass to the late man in the high slot is considered one of the highest percentage scoring looks in all of hockey.
The invisible threat in the blind spot. Let's pivot back to the blue line defense. A defenseman has a crucial micro decision to make as the attacker crosses the blue line. Stand up versus back off. Walk me through the risk assessment of that split second choice.
Stand up means the defenseman firmly plants their skates, stops moving backward, and meets the attacker right at the physical boundary of the blue line. You refuse to surrender an inch of territory inside your zone. The tactical goal is to completely deny the controlled entry, forcing the attacker to either dump the puck in or attempt to stick handle through a static obstacle.
Which sounds ideal, but what is the bet you are making?
You are betting your entire defensive sequence on the fact that you have back pressure support, because the physical risk is enormous. If you are standing completely still and the attacker is moving at 25 kilometers an hour and they manage to slip the puck past you, you are dead in the water.
Yeah.
You physically cannot pivot from a standstill and accelerate fast enough to catch a player already moving at top speed. You are relying entirely on a back-checking forward to clean up your mess.
So if you look up and realize you don't have that back pressure support, you default to the back-off method.
Yes. Backing off means you continue skating backward, willingly conceding the physical blue line to the attacker. You allow them to carry the puck into your zone. However, your goal shifts from denial to containment. You use your stick and body positioning to keep the attacker in front of you, actively funneling them toward the outside boards where their shooting angle is poor. You lose the territorial battle, but you protect the high-danger real estate in the middle of the ice, buying time for your forwards to eventually catch up.
Now, I have to address a safety and rules issue regarding the blue line defense. You mentioned a defenseman deciding to step up. When amateur players hear step up, they often visualize those classic, devastating open ice highlight hits. A defenseman stepping up and launching an attacker into the third row because the attacker was looking down at the puck. Is that the goal of a step up?
This is perhaps the most critical misconception in physical defending, and it carries severe penalties in the modern game. A step up is a purely tactical, spatial choice. It means closing the physical space with your feet to force a turnover or a dump in. It is absolutely not a license to deliver a devastating predatory hit.
But the old school mentality is, keep your head up. If you are staring at your skates crossing the blue line, You get what's coming to you. Doesn't the onus fall on the puck carrier?
That mentality has been actively legislated out of the game for safety reasons. From a modern coaching perspective, if an attacker is staring down at the puck, it simply communicates one piece of tactical information to the defenseman. The attacker cannot see the ice, therefore they cannot quickly change direction.
Right.
That allows the defenseman to aggressively close the gap and easily strip the puck. It does not grant you legal permission to destroy a vulnerable player, and the rule books are incredibly specific about penalizing this behavior.
How specific are we talking?
Let's look directly at the USA Hockey Casebook, Rule 607, Situation 2. It presents a specific scenario. A player sees an unsuspecting opponent skating up the ice with their head down and travels a great distance across the ice at full speed to deliver a hard body check. The ruling explicitly states this must be penalized as charging.
Oh, wow.
The rationale provided is that the defender took advantage of a vulnerable opponent and traveled a significant distance specifically to punish them, rather than simply attempting to make a defensive hockey play to separate the player from the puck.
Wow, they explicitly address the head-down scenario as a reason to penalize the hitter, not excuse them.
They do. And the mechanical definition of charging varies fascinatingly across the books. Hockey Canada defines charging as taking two or more strides before delivering the hit. USA Hockey defines it as taking more than two strides. The International IIHF rulebook avoids numbers entirely, simply stating multiple strides. And the NHL rulebook doesn't specify strides at all. It bases the penalty subjectively on the distance traveled to deliver the hit.
So the literal mechanics of the penalty are slightly different everywhere, but the philosophical intent is universal. You cannot hunt vulnerable players in open ice.
Exactly. And crucially, if you misinterpret a step up and cross that line, none of these major rulebooks cap a charging penalty at a simple 2-minute minor. USA Hockey, for instance, doesn't even offer a bare minor for charging. The absolute minimum penalty a referee can assess is a minor plus a 10-minute misconduct, or a major plus a game misconduct. If you decide to step up to deliver a massive predatory hit instead of playing the tactical gap, you are going to the penalty box, and you are likely done for the night.
Message received. Play the spatial gap, win the puck, don't hunt the head. All right, let's shift the paradigm entirely. We've talked about defending the neutral zone. Now let's talk about holding the puck in the neutral zone. I want to introduce a concept that feels deeply counterintuitive to anyone who hasn't played at a high level. Listener, consider this. What if the absolute best way to advance the puck forward is to intentionally skate backward?
This concept is the dividing line between amateur panic and professional poise. When an amateur player receives the puck in the neutral zone, they feel an overwhelming, almost physical compulsion to force the puck forward toward the offensive net, regardless of how many defenders are in the way. They will chip it into a crowd, try to stick handle through three guys, anything to just keep moving north.
Right.
A professional player operates entirely differently. A professional will frequently look at a wall of defenders, recognize a low percentage entry, and actively decline it to buy a better one. That intentional reset is called a regroup.
Turning the puck backward, retreating toward your own end to maintain possession. Why does retreating give you an advantage? It feels like you are willingly giving up hard-earned territory.
You aren't retreating out of fear. You are retreating to manipulate the opponent's structure. If you force a pass forward into a set 1-3-1 trap, you'll turn the puck over. If instead you curl backward and pass the puck back to your trailing defenseman, three distinct advantages materialize.
Okay, what's the first one?
First, and most importantly, you maintain possession of the puck. You live to fight another second. Second, the opposing team's defensive structure, which was naturally drifting forward to pressure you, now has to suddenly hit the brakes, stop, and turn around to adjust to the backward pass.
Yeah.
And fundamentally, turning around is the slowest, most cumbersome physical action a player can perform on ice skates.
You are forcing their structure to lose momentum. And the third advantage?
The third advantage is the offensive payload. By passing the puck backward, you afford your own forwards the time to curl back into their own end, wind up, and build tremendous speed. When they finally receive the next forward pass, they are hitting the offensive blue line, moving 25 kilometers an hour, rather than trying to receive a pass while standing perfectly flat-footed at the red line. Speed violently shatters structural defense. The regroup sacrifices 50 feet of territory to manufacture 25 kilometers an hour of momentum.
Okay, the theory is brilliant. Let's walk through the physical execution. The forward hits a wall at the red line and passes the puck backward to D1. What is D1's next move?
The immediate pivot of the tactic is the lateral D-to-D pass. The defenseman who receives the puck instantly fires a flat horizontal pass across the width of the ice to their defense partner, D2. This lateral pass completely changes the point of attack. It forces the entire opposing trap, which was heavily shaded to one side of the ice, to frantically slide horizontally to reestablish their lanes.
Which opens up seams as they scramble. But there is a massive inherent risk to a lateral pass in the neutral zone, isn't there?
It is the golden rule of defensive play. Never, ever pass blind across the middle of the ice. If an opposing forechecker anticipates that D2D pass and intercepts it in the center lane, it is an instant catastrophic odd man rush the other way, and both of your defensemen are caught moving horizontally away from the play.
So what happens if D1 looks over and sees that the D2D pass isn't safe? What if a forechecker is blanketing their partner? They can't pass forward, they can't pass sideways, are they stuck?
That is when you employ a secondary tactic called the hinge, or specifically the skating hinge.
How does a hinge work?
Under normal circumstances, after a defenseman makes a D2D pass, they follow their partner up the ice, skating vertically up the boards to support the play. In a hinge, you do the opposite. After passing the puck to your partner, or if your partner simply takes the puck up the boards themselves, you intentionally sink backward, retreating deep into the middle of your own defensive zone, settling into the empty ice behind the play.
You purposefully take yourself out of the forward rush. Why?
You are creating an ultimate safety valve. If your partner skates up the boards, hits a wall of defenders, and realizes they have absolutely no forward options, they don't have to panic. They know you are hovering in the middle of the ice behind them. They simply bank the puck backward to you. When you receive that hinge pass, you are in the most advantageous position on the rink. You are behind the play, stationed in the center lane, facing up ice, with the entire rink and all nine other skaters perfectly within your field of vision. You have all the time in the world to survey the ice and launch a secondary attack.
You are buying time and buying vision by retreating into space. What about an even deeper retreat? I hear coaches talk about a low regroup.
A low regroup occurs when a defenseman takes the puck all the way back below their own goal line, essentially restarting the play from scratch as if it were a fresh defensive zone breakout. You employ this when the neutral zone is completely clogged, the trap is fully set, and your forwards are chaotic and need time to sort out their designated lanes before attempting an entry.
But if a defenseman takes it below their own goal line, can't they just leave the puck for their goalie, let the goalie stop it, freeze it, and get a whistle to calm things down?
Here is where the specific rule books rear their heads again, specifically regarding the goalie trapezoid. Under NHL and IIHF rules, goalies are strictly penalized for playing the puck behind the goal line if they are physically outside of the painted trapezoid area behind the net.
Right, the delay of game penalty.
Exactly. Now, USA Hockey and Hockey Canada rules do not feature a trapezoid. The goalie is free to wander into the corners to play the puck as much as they want. However, there is always a catch.
There is always a however in the rule book.
However, under USA Hockey Rule 614C and Hockey Canada Rule 10.1A, a goalie cannot simply fall on or freeze the puck outside the confines of the goal crease to intentionally cause a stoppage of play, unless they explicitly came out of the crease to cut down the angle for an impending shot. So, if a defenseman runs a low regroup and leaves the puck in the corner, the goalie can go retrieve it and pass it, but they must keep the play alive. If they smother it in the corner just to get a whistle, they will be assessed a minor penalty for delay of game.
The goalie can act as a distribution point, but not a safety blanket. Good distinction. Let's look at the forwards during these regroups. While the defensemen are passing DDD or hinging, what are the forwards doing? What is the most common mistake amateur forwards make during a regroup?
The cardinal sin of a forward during a regroup is standing perfectly still at the blue line, waving their stick, and screaming for the puck. If a forward receives a regroup pass while their skates are completely static, they have entirely wasted the tactical purpose of the regroup. The entire goal was to generate momentum.
So how do they time their routes to ensure they have speed?
The coaching cue is to swing with the puck. As the initial pass goes backward to the defenseman, the forward must curl back toward their own end, ensuring they stay physically below the level of the puck. Then, as the lateral D2D pass moves across the ice, the forward anticipates the target, turns up ice, and accelerates. The geometry is timed so that the forward is hitting their absolute top speed at the exact moment the forward pass hits the tape of their stick.
Timing is everything. It's like a wide receiver timing a crossing route perfectly. Are there scenarios where a team should absolutely not attempt a regroup?
Absolutely. Systems should never override common sense. First, if an odd man rush is organically developing, if you have a 3-on-2 advantage, you attack immediately. Never throw away a numerical advantage just to execute a rigid regroup system. Second, fatigue dictates tactics. If your forward line has been on the ice for 60 seconds and their legs are full of lactic acid, do not execute a regroup that forces them to skate an additional 200 feet. Dump the puck deep, get to the bench, and change lines. And finally, never attempt to regroup directly into aggressive forechecking pressure. A poorly executed pass backward under pressure isn't a regroup. It's a catastrophic turnover in your own zone.
Let's synthesize all of this. We are entering the final tactical phase, attacking and dismantling the trap. You have the puck, you are looking up the ice, and you see a perfectly executed 1-3-1 trap waiting for you. How do we systematically tear it apart? Let's start with positional discipline.
To dismantle a trap, you must first establish strict lane discipline. Mentally divide the neutral zone into three distinct vertical lanes: the left wall, the center, and the right wall. The golden, unbreakable rule for the attacking forwards is one player per lane.
Why is the rule so rigid? If the puck is on the left wall, shouldn't the center skate over to help out?
That is a fundamental misunderstanding of what support means in hockey. In the neutral zone, supporting the puck carrier means being available in a different spatial area, providing a passing option. It does not mean being physically close to them. If the puck goes to the left wall and the center skates all the way over to the left wall to help, you now have two offensive players occupying a single lane. The defense only needs one defender to effectively guard both of you. You have essentially done the defense's job for them by compressing your own space, turning a 5-on-5 game into a 5-on-4 disadvantage.
Right. You are voluntarily suffocating your own offense. Spread out, one man per lane. Force the defense to cover the entire width of the ice. Okay, our lanes are set. What specific tactical weapons do we use to penetrate the structure? We discussed the stretch pass earlier.
The stretch pass is your primary countermeasure against a 1-3-1 or a retreated 1-2-2 trap that anchors itself at the center red line. Mm-hmm. Remember the geography. If the defensive wall is built at the red line, there is 50 feet of vast, empty, unguarded ice behind that wall before you hit the offensive blue line.
And because the ghost rule is dead, we can legally bomb a pass into that space.
Exactly. You intentionally leak one forward high, sending them skating past the red line, lurking in the empty space behind the defensive wall. This forces the defense into an impossible binary choice. If the defense holds their line and ignores the high forward, your defenseman launches a 70-foot stretch pass right over their heads, sending your forward in on a clean breakaway.
And if the defense gets terrified at the breakaway and drops back to cover the stretch forward?
If they drop back, the defensive wall crumbles. By retreating, they just opened up all the ice in front of them, allowing your puck carrier to simply skate forward and gain the zone with zero resistance. The stretch pass manipulates the defense's depth.
But you noted earlier that the stretch pass is completely useless against a 1-4 retreat. Why?
Because of where the 1-4 builds its wall. The 1-4 lines up all four defenders directly on their own defensive blue line. There is absolutely no legal ice behind them. If you attempt to leak a forward behind a 1-4, that forward is standing inside the offensive zone. The moment you attempt a stretch pass, it is offside.
So if a stretch pass won't work and carrying it through four guys won't work, what is the weapon to defeat a tight 1-4 at the blue line?
The chip and chase. But it is vital to understand that a proper chip is not a blind, panicked clearance. It is a highly precise tactical placement. You are softly chipping the puck off the glass or banking it lightly off the boards, aiming specifically to place it right past the physical hip of the stationary defender into the empty space behind them, allowing your forward with forward momentum to win the foot race to the loose puck. What are the critical rules for executing a chip and chase? Two things. First, structurally, you must have your wingers actively accelerating to chase the chip. If you chip it in and nobody chases, you haven't executed a tactic. You've simply handed the puck to the opponent. Second, you must be hyper aware of the center red line regarding icing. If you attempt a chip and chase while you are still on your own defensive side of the red line and the puck carries all the way down the ice, that is an icing infraction.
Which brings a whole separate strategic punishment.
Exactly. Under NHL and international rules, if you ice the puck at even strength, your team is legally prohibited from substituting players before the ensuing defensive zone faceoff. If your line is exhausted, tries a desperate long chip from the wrong side of the red line and gets whistled for icing, those tired players are forced to stay on the ice for a high-leverage defensive draw against fresh opponents. It is a fatal error.
So weapon one is the stretch pass. Weapon two is the chip and chase. What is weapon three?
Weapon three is the wall, middle wall passing sequence. This is designed to completely disorient a set structure by violently changing the point of attack.
No.
The puck starts with a winger on the outside wall. They execute a hard pass into the center lane to a supporting forward who instantly one-touches the puck out to the winger on the far opposite wall.
Okay, I have to push back hard on this one. Every coach I've ever had has told me that passing into the middle of the neutral zone is suicidal. It is the most congested, dangerous area on the rink. Why are we actively targeting it?
You are identifying the exact tension of the play. Yes, the middle of the ice is the most dangerous place to possess the puck. That is why the wall-middle wall sequence relies entirely on the middle player acting as a one-touch relay station. You cannot pass the puck to the center, have the center stick handle, look around, and survey their options. If they do that, they will be violently separated from the puck.
They have to know where the puck is going before it even arrives.
Exactly. The center must physically scan the ice before the pass is made. They receive the puck and instantly redirect it to the far side. When executed properly, that rapid lateral puck movement forces the entire five-man defensive structure to violently slide across the ice twice in less than 2 seconds. And as a fundamental rule of hockey geometry, sliding, shifting structures always inevitably open up passing seams.
So if I'm trying to distill the ultimate offensive mindset for defeating a complex trap, what is the core philosophy?
The ultimate mantra is this. A trap is designed to defeat players who try to carry the puck through it. A trap is completely powerless against teams that pass the puck through it. The puck moves infinitely faster than any human can skate. Make the puck do the work.
But wait, earlier you cited the MIT Sloan Analytics paper that mathematically proved carrying the puck into the zone is worth twice as many shots as dumping it in. Are you contradicting the analytics?
This is where analytics require tactical context. Yes, a successfully controlled carry-in is worth twice as much offensive production. However, you have to factor in the probability of success. A dump-in that you aggressively chase with 3 forecheckers is worth infinitely more than turning the puck over at the opposing blue line because you stubbornly try to dangle through 3 set defenders.
So it's a calculation of risk versus reward based on the defense's posture.
Exactly. The prevailing analytics models suggest a confidence threshold. If you survey the neutral zone and are less than 33% confident that you can successfully carry the puck through the opposing structure, the mathematically correct play is to intentionally dump it in and initiate a heavy forecheck. The trap relies entirely on your impatience. It waits for you to attempt a low percentage hero play. The ultimate trap beater is patience. You refuse to force it, you regroup, you pass laterally, or you confidently dump it in and dare them to break the puck out against your forecheck.
Make them come to you. I love that. Before we move to our final synthesis, there is one highly specific scenario in the neutral zone we need to cover. It is the only time play actually comes to a complete scheduled halt. Neutral zone faceoffs.
This is a micro battle of pure geometry. There are 4 neutral zone faceoff dots located exactly 44 feet apart and stationed 5 feet outside the respective blue lines.
When 2 centers line up for a draw 5 feet outside the blue line, what are the competing objectives?
It depends entirely on which blue line you are standing near. If the faceoff is taking place right outside your own defensive blue line, your goal is survival. You are trying to prevent the attacking team from winning the puck cleanly backward to their defenseman, which will allow them to instantly step into a shot or initiate a controlled zone entry. The defensive goal is to win the puck forward, hack it out of the zone, and quickly get fresh players on the ice. If you are the attacking team taking a draw outside the opponent's blue line, your goal is that clean backward win to set up an offensive strike, or to intentionally win the puck softly to the outside wall so your winger can immediately chip it deep and ignite a forecheck.
Faceoff seems so simple, but the rule book gets incredibly pedantic here, particularly regarding the wingers. There is a specific warning about wingers creeping into the circle too early, right?
Yes, the encroachment rule. And it is uniquely punishing. If a winger gets overeager and jumps into the faceoff circle before the puck is dropped, the referee blows the whistle. But they don't penalize the winger who committed the infraction. They punish the center. The referee will physically eject the center from the faceoff circle, forcing a winger to step in and take the draw against a faceoff specialist.
The poor center takes the fall for his teammate's impatience.
It gets progressively worse. If the team brings in the replacement winger to take the draw, and a player commits a second encroachment violation on the exact same faceoff attempt, it elevates from an ejection to a physical penalty. Under NHL rules, a second violation on the same draw results in a bench minor penalty for delay of game. Under USA hockey rules, the individual player who committed this second violation is assessed a minor penalty.
And earlier, you mentioned a bizarre quirk regarding face-off violations in the UK leagues.
Yes, it is a fascinating local interpretation. In the UK, under their specific reading of the rules, if there is a face-off violation, the lines person will immediately eject and replace the center on the first offense for virtually any violation without issuing the standard verbal warning that you see in North American professional leagues. The only exception is on a face-off following an icing, where the offending center is not allowed to be changed.
Hockey rule books are an absolute labyrinth. Okay, we have covered the geometry, the analytics, the structures, the regroups, and the face-offs. Let's build a practical, real-time tool for the listener. You are a defenseman. You just retrieved the puck in your own zone. You are skating forward, looking up the ice. You have 1.5 seconds to read the entire neutral zone. Give me the mental checklist.
Number one, locate and read F1's route. If the opposing F1 is skating straight at you, hard and fast, they are running an aggressive pressure forecheck. You counter this by utilizing one quick, crisp pass to a supporting winger to bypass him, and suddenly you have an odd man advantage moving up the ice.
What if F1 isn't coming straight at me? What if they are looping in a wide arc?
If F1 is arcing and intentionally leaving one side of the boards open, they are setting a trap. They are trying to herd you into a funnel. Do not take the bait. Do not skate into the alley they are leaving open. Counter this by immediately passing the puck laterally to change the side of the attack.
And what if F1 is just gliding backward or standing completely still near the center red line?
Then they are deploying a passive 1-3-1 or a 1-4 retreat. There is no immediate physical pressure on you. The counter is patience. Take your time, keep your head up, assess the passing lanes, and if nothing is open, confidently initiate a regroup to buy time for your forwards.
That's step one. What is number two on the checklist?
Number two is count the bodies. Look specifically at the middle lane of the ice. If you see two offending bodies stacked vertically, there is space to attack the gaps between them. If you look up and see three defending bodies lined up perfectly flat horizontally across the ice, it is a 1-3-1 wall. Immediately look for your high forward to attempt a stretch pass over the top. If you look up and see four bodies standing shoulder to shoulder directly on their blue line, it is a 1-4. The pass is dead. Prepare your wingers for a hard chip and chase.
Number three.
Check your internal support. Where are your own wingers? Are they maintaining strict lane discipline, or have they collapsed into the same lane, destroying your passing options?
And the final read on the checklist.
Watch the feet of the defending defenseman at the opposing blue line. If their skates are pointed sideways and they are gliding backward, they are conceding the blue line. Take the ice and carry the puck in. But if their feet are firmly planted, pointing straight forward, and they are standing completely still, they are stepping up to hit you. Do not try to dangle them. Chip the puck hard past their hip and accelerate into the zone.
Read F1, count the bodies, check your support, read the defense's feet. Brilliant. We have reached the outro. Our final mastery review. We've thrown a massive amount of tactical theory at you today. To solidify this, let's put you, the listener, right in the middle of a scenario that integrates everything we've learned. Let's walk through the perfect neutral zone sequence.
Imagine you are D1. You recover the puck in your own end. You look up and execute your 1.5 second checklist. You read F1, he's gliding backward. You count the bodies in the middle. There are three flat across the red line. You instantly recognize the 1-3-1 trap. You know the analytics. Carrying it through three set defenders is a low percentage play.
So you don't force it. You utilize the first principle of defeating the trap, patience. You execute a regroup, skating backward to maintain possession and force that 1-3-1 structure to turn around.
Exactly. You look to execute the D-to-D pass to change the point of attack, but you remember the golden rule. Never pass blind across the middle. You see a forechecker blanketing your partner. So you employ the hinge. You sink backward into the safety of the center ice, giving yourself ultimate vision.
Meanwhile, your forwards are not standing still. They are swinging with the puck, maintaining their strict three-lane discipline, ensuring one man per lane so the defense has to cover the full width of the ice.
With your forwards accelerating, you look up to deploy your weapons. Because the two-line pass is dead, you look for the stretch pass over the 1-3-1. But the defense is disciplined. They have retreated their lone safety defenseman to cover it.
So you pivot to weapon number three, the wall-middle-wall sequence. You hit your winger on the boards, who one touches it to the center. The center, having already scanned the ice before receiving the puck, instantly relays it to the far winger, hitting the blue line at top speed.
That lateral movement forces the defense to scramble. The defending defenseman is caught without back pressure from his forwards, so he is forced to concede the gap and back off. You carry the puck cleanly over the blue line, mathematically doubling your team's chance of generating a shot on goal. You have successfully dictated the terms of the game.
You turned their trap into your transition offense. That is the mastery of the neutral zone. But I want to leave you with one final provocative thought to mull over, something that pushes beyond the X's and O's we've discussed today. We have spent an hour breaking down the human geometry of the ice, how human players read, react, make mistakes, and exhibit patience or impatience. But the sport is currently undergoing a massive technological revolution. The NHL has implemented the Edge Puck and Player Tracking System. Every single player and the puck itself contains a microchip transmitting precise X and Y coordinates, velocity, and trajectory dozens of times a second.
That's right.
Think about the implications of that data for the neutral zone. Right now, a player has 3 seconds to intuitively calculate the geometry of a 1-3-1 trap based on their own flawed human vision. But what happens in 5 years when coaches feed that tracking data into an AI model? What happens when a computer can mathematically prove that if F1 is standing at coordinate X and moving at velocity Y, the absolute mathematically perfect trajectory for a stretch pass is exactly 43.2 degrees across the ice?
That changes everything.
Will the intuitive art of navigating the neutral zone die? Will players eventually be equipped with augmented reality visors, seeing literal glowing passing lanes drawn on the ice in real time? Or will coaches simply program their players to act like algorithms, executing pre-calculated robotic routes that perfectly exploit the mathematical vulnerabilities of any given structure? If the neutral zone is fundamentally a math problem of time and space, what happens to the beauty of the game when a computer permanently solves the math? Keep an eye on the transition game the next time you tune in. Watch the chess match unfold, watch the traps being set, and the regroups pushing back. You are now officially equipped to watch and play the game like a pro. Thanks for joining us in the Engine Room. We'll see you on the next deep dive.